Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Mindshift Podcast. This is a bonus episode, and I've got a fantastic guest, Andre Gagne from Montreal Concordia University. We're going to be talking to him in just a minute. If you've been listening to my episodes that I've been doing on Dominion Theology, I did a bonus episode a few months back, and it's been a while to get back in touch on this subject, but I've been doing a tremendous amount of research, and one of the people I've tapped here is Professor Gagne, because he is an expert on dominion theology. So this is kind of a part two. So I'm very interested to talk to him. And if you want to reach out to me, let me know what your thoughts and questions are on this episode. And I'm also going to put Professor Gagne's social media contacts as well in the show notes. So I'm very interested. You can follow me on Twitter. That's probably the best place to get a hold of me. At MindShift2018. You can send me a DM there, or you can look up the MindShift Podcast Facebook page if you're on Facebook as well. I'm going to welcome now my guest on this subject of Dominion Theology, Dr. Andre Gagne from Concordia University in Montreal in Canada. So welcome to MindShift Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for your kind invitation. This is really a pleasure and an honor to be speaking with you today.
I'm glad we finally got together, because I think we were talking about doing this podcast several months back, but
yes, you've
been very busy. And actually, though, I think this has been a better time to do this. Obviously, you've gotten a little bit less stressed with your semester starting, haven't you? But I've been doing more and more and more research, so now I've actually compiled more questions for you. So I don't know if that's a good thing for you.
I don't know. I will see.
So what I did was I sent Dr. Gagne, or can I just call you Andre? Is that better?
Yes.
Okay.
Come on.
So I sent Andre a list of talking points, and he very helpfully highlighted a bunch of things in green. And actually, I was going to say most of the things that I sent you, you highlighted. There was only a couple things that. And highlights. So we did well to kind of hit the main highlights, but I guess this is the question to start with. If someone's never heard of Dominion Theology, what actually is it? Can you give us sort of a brief overview of a definition of this thing?
Yes, I think that's the most important question. We hear about dominionism or dominion theology. It's becoming something that people are more and more aware of, especially on social media, and people are writing also about it. I think that one of the best definitions that I've come across is from one of my colleagues by the name of Frederick Clarkson, who is a researcher with Political Research Associates in the U.S. And so I'm just going to actually quote his definition, because I think it's great, and it really covers what we mean by this idea. Because there's a lot of confusion sometimes, and people are not sure, and sometimes people have a tendency of labeling a bit left and right, extremist movements as being dominionist. But this is what it is in a nutshell. It's essentially a theocratic idea. Dominionism is a theocratic idea that, regardless of the theological view, means, or timetable, it's this idea that Christians are called by God to exercise dominion over every aspect of society by taking control of political and cultural institutions. So what's important here is that there's this idea of theocracy. When we talk about theocracy, we mean God's rule. And it's this idea that, tied to theocracy, that Christians have the authority to exercise dominion in the political and cultural spheres. And what's very significant about dominionism, and what dominion theology has managed to do, is that it still managed to function regardless of the Christian theology that one embraces, and even, I would say, even the eschatology that one embraces. So it you know, people that share dominionist ideas have different theologies. Some can be Reformed, Calvinist. Some could be more charismatic or Pentecostal. Some people could be post-millennial, and often we've associated dominion theology with post-millennialism, but we've seen more and more premillennialists that are adopting a dominionist perspective, right? They kind of obey, or they kind of see themselves as fulfilling the requirement that Jesus says in one of the parables. He says, "Occupy till I come." So they see this as their mandate to occupy, to be busy in preaching the gospel and making sure that God's kingdom is proclaimed throughout the land. So essentially, independently of the theological view, the means, and the timetable, Christians are called to rule. Now, if I can just elaborate a little more, Clint, on this, where do they get this in the Bible? Because often, you know, they root themselves, or they root these ideas, at least in a particular reading of Scripture. Most of the dominionists, or those that embrace this kind of theology, often refer to Genesis 1, verses 26 to 28 as the kind of basis on which this idea comes from. It's essentially in the creation story of humankind, where God says, "Let us create man," or "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule." This idea of ruling over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And later on in verse 28, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So it's about ruling the earth, subduing the earth. Now, the New Testament equivalent of that is Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 to 20, which is the final commission, where Jesus says to his disciples that he is with them always, and that he sends them, and they have a responsibility to make disciples out of all nations, encouraging men and women to obey all that he commanded. So this is where this dominionist idea comes from. This is where it's rooted, at least from a biblical perspective. And this is what it means.
Yeah, you beat me to it, because I was going to ask you, where do they get their biblical basis? But yeah, that seems to be it, isn't it? The idea of dominion comes from the Genesis 1:28, yeah. Rule the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over it. And they would say, yeah, that is a biblical mandate to have dominion. Now, is this something we should be concerned about? Because what you, in your description of it, the thing about it that really struck me was it was at the all-pervasive nature of it. It has infiltrated Christianity, evangelicalism, denominations, and it's kind of this, almost like a virus that's crept in a way, and it's slipped through the front doors of many a church. I hear Christians spouting dominionist theology, even though they would say, "I don't believe in dominion theology." For example, someone who says, "Oh, America used to be a Christian nation," I've heard that is kind of a dominion talking point. Mm-hmm. Is that what you find? It's a very pervasive movement.
Absolutely. I think you've mentioned very important elements there, especially in terms of should we be weary, you know? Mm. When we think about dominionism, I think that where it's most worrisome, it's how it exploits the political sphere. I think that this is where it is most dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, people can have all sorts of beliefs. They could believe that Jesus is the master of the universe, or he rules the world, you know, from a kind of a spiritual type of perspective. You know, there's people that can believe that. But when it creeps into the Christian right, what we call the Christian right, this kind of coalition of, conservative evangelicals, Catholics, and Protestants that have a political religious agenda, that is where we should be worried. And when we talk about the Christian right essentially is comprised of various types of people. You have, of course, Christian conservatives. These are people that are, that have social conservative views and values, and they are not necessarily dominionist, but they care that their own values might be respected. They don't want to lose their own rights to their own social values and worldview. Where the problem comes in the Christian right is with Christian nationalists and Christian theocrats. Now, Christian nationalists, you've talked about that when you mentioned where people say, America is a Christian nation, or America has always been a Christian nation, and the primacy of Christianity should be in America. Christianity is not like the other religions. Should not be treated like any other religion. It is the main religion, and the foundations of American society is Christianity. It's Judeo-Christian values. Mm-hmm. This Christian nationalism, that's dangerous. And Christian theocrats or Christian theocracy goes even further in saying that, the laws of the land should be the laws of the Bible. The laws of God, and we should endeavor in bringing about a profound social transformation culturally and politically. So the danger is really when dominionism is brought through the Christian right into the sphere of politics, and this is where we are. Essentially, this is what we're seeing in several places across the globe. The most evident manifestation of this is in the U.S. at the moment. But we've seen manifestations of this in Brazil with Bolsonaro's electoral victory. We're not immune to this here in Canada. We have a strong conservative opposition here in Canada that sometimes some of the people that belong to the Conservative Party in Canada do exhibit dominionist tendencies. So, I think we need to be concerned, and we need to be aware of the talking points that these people use. What are their strategies? What are they trying to say? And one of the things you said, Clint, is often they will deny it.
Absolutely.
They will say, no, we don't believe in this, or this is not correct. What I've noticed when I look and I study some of these people, what I notice is that they have a public discourse and they have a private discourse. In the public sphere, when they're confronted with journalists and scholars in the secular world on this question, they're going to kind of deny this or play down this idea that no, we're not, this idea of dominionism. Even some people go as far as saying there's no such thing as the new apostolic reformation. Lance Wallnau said this a couple of years ago, things like that. But when they're amongst themselves, and if you read their literature, and this is why it's so important reading primary sources and listening to their conferences and what they say in their meetings, it's clearly a dominionist mandate. That can be quite worrisome, definitely.
It very much is. I'm convinced of what you just said, because I know we're going to get into some of these names, but for example, Mike Bickle and IHOP Church in Kansas City, I did a ton of research on their own website, and I scoured that site. There's almost no, I just did a search on the word dominion, and only I got a very, like, two hits, and it wasn't related to any of this stuff. And then he said, we decry, dominion theology. We don't believe in it. I'm like, that cannot be true. I'm convinced that that is a lie. Yeah. That's not true, because of the names and that they're all associated with. When you start sleuthing out the names, that's where I've been tracing it out. you find a name of one person who's influential in the movement, and then they the circles they're running in, that's the critical bit, is you start connecting them up with other key players, and you start going, okay, this cannot be true, what you're saying publicly, as you say.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's the thing. That's exactly the thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's funny, because there's people that are not even aware that what they believe sometimes is dominionism.
Exactly.
You know, they're not even aware of the ideas that are circulating, that it's actually called dominionism. But in the end, it is.
Exactly. It's like we said, it's infiltrated the church, and
yeah,
people aren't even aware of the talking points.
That's it. They're not aware, you know? And of course, Beckel, when you talk about Beckel, and I'm sure you know this, when he started with the you know, his Kansas City church, but at first it was Kansas City Metro something Christian Assembly or whatever, and it was tied to very early on to Wimber in the 80s,
exactly,
with the Vineyard churches. And eventually he disconnected with that when the Toronto Blessing happened in the 90s. He kind of disconnected from the Vineyard churches, because the Toronto Blessing people who had belonged to Vineyard disconnected themselves or dissociated themselves from Wimber and the Vineyard churches. But at first he was very much in the, Beckel was very much in the, what we call the third wave,
mm-hmm,
of the Holy Spirit movement. He was very much rooted in that. And his main concern was about prophecy and prophets. And early on, you have all the issue around the Kansas City prophets.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Kansas City prophets.
Yeah.
He comes out of that movement.
That's it. So that came out of there. And then Wimber, they got to know Wimber, and Wimber was quite impressed with what was happening in Kansas City. And Wimber made sure that the Kansas City Christian Fellowship became a Vineyard church at one point.
Mm.
And so it was incorporated into the Vineyard movement. But all of this, you see, that what we call dominionism and everything, it was all kind of part of this, without them necessarily, because they're not, you know, they're not very much theologians, these guys, you see? So they pick up ideas left and right without necessarily always understanding the implications of these ideas. So there, you know, a lot of them probably never heard of Rushduni, you know, mm-hmm, who is the father of Christian Reconstructionism, and what we understand as being, who really popularized dominion theology as we can understand it up to a certain extent today. So yes, you know, they'll say no, but in private circles it is that, and it is the talking points about dominion theology, but dominion theology for them is a dirty word almost. So they're not going to use the term, you see, because of the negative connotations that it has for certain people and how it resonates badly with certain people. So they're not going to use the term, but all the ideas are there. All the ideas are still there.
Exactly. You got to know what to listen for. It's like key terms, key phrases, key words that they'll use. They're sort of like code words for other things. Well, now, where does this movement come from? I mean, broadly speaking, you mentioned R.J. Rushduni. He's the father or grandfather of a lot of this stuff. What about some of the key names? Because I know the name C. Peter Wagner comes up out of Fuller Seminary. He's deceased now, isn't he? But where does this movement come from? Because it's not like you could say Orthodox Christianity dating back to Augustine and Aquinas and Calvin and those guys. This is a fairly new movement, isn't it?
In a sense, yes. And
maybe not.
At the same time, what's interesting is that some of these ideas still go back to Augustine and to Calvin.
Right,
and
they can trace
to the
that
Reformation,
line.
Yes, and to the Reformation leaders, and to people like Albert Kuyper in the early 20th century, who was prime minister of the Netherlands for a certain period of time, but he was a Calvinist. And he promoted the idea of sphere sovereignty, which is very similar to what we call today Seven Mountains Mandate.
Hmm.
These are Calvinists.
Right. So the ideas go back centuries for sure.
Yes, yes. But the thing is, it's like now it's so like mainstream, you see. Mm-hmm. This you used to find in austere Calvinistic circles, you see. But now you have it in Pentecostal circles, charismatic circles, and in non-denominational churches, and it goes by different names. But yes, it's rooted from there. And when you think about a guy like Rushdoony in the 60s, Rushdoony, who passed away in 2001, was a Presbyterian minister, when you think about it.
Hmm.
He was a Presbyterian minister. He was extremely prolific in his writings. And for him, it was all about taking God's word seriously. So, and of course, he this is why he talks about what is called Christian Reconstructionism. It's to reconstruct society on Christianity. Huh? So it's to reconstruct and give society its Judeo-Christian base. Eh? It's to bring back Christianity into society and rebuild society on Christian values. So for him, it was about one of the important things was that society should be based on this idea of theonomy, which was God's law. That means that, you know, inspiring himself from Kuyper that talked about sphere sovereignty, he said, like, all of our lives, the state, the personal life, family, should be under God's rule and God's authority.
That's a
later on, this
point.
Was developed into the Seven Mountains Mandate. Okay, later on, with people like Bill Bright and Lauren Conningham and others, they kind of mapped it out as the seven mountains. But at first, it's these spheres of society, yeah? In the individual, family, society in general, civil government, and so on. And God should rule. The law of God should be at the basis of all of these spheres. God should rule. Jesus should be the ruler of each of these spheres. This is dominion. You see? This is dominion. This is God ruling in each of these spheres. So if you start by yourself, and then if you let God rule in your life, that's going to have an effect on your family. And then the family, if God rules in the family and God rules in many families, that's going to have an effect on society. And if God rules in society, then that's going to have an effect on the political sphere and the civil government and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it's built, you see. It starts like this idea that God rules. God rules the world. And it's in the Bible, of course. It's in the Bible.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
You know, it's there. It's there.
God's the king of everything, yeah.
That's it. But as you know, and you understand this very, very correctly, as you being a biblical scholar, in Genesis 1, it's not about Christians ruling the world. It's a general humankind mandate of taking care of God's creation.
Right. You see, it's more about stewardship, isn't it?
That's it. But for them, it's like since the fall of man or the fall of humankind, Satan has conquered the world, and now through Christians, God will reconquer this earth. And that is their mandate. You see, essentially that is their mandate. So they of course, they project themselves as Christians back into the original Genesis 1 mandate, which is a general humankind mandate. So it's a particular way of reading scripture. Right? It's a particular.
Absolutely, yeah. A literalist reading. As you say, the concern is when they start injecting themselves, often behind the scenes. And that's why I was so fascinated by the documentary on the family, because I'd never heard of that organization before. I heard a couple of names in that series that I knew, but this was all this revelation that it was an intentionally invisible organization, designedly so, to be, you know, infiltrating the corridors of power, not just in places like Washington, D.C. and Congress and the White House, but in other countries, as you said, around the world, meeting with key leaders and prime ministers and dictators and billionaires and millionaires and key influencers in society. And the National Prayer Breakfast, which is their only sort of visible event that they do every year in Washington. Everywhere else, they're behind the scenes. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know who they're talking to. We know some of what they're talking about because Jeff Charlotte has pulled the veil back a little bit.
Yeah.
But then when you start to see some of the things that come out of that is, for example, the anti-LGBTQ legislation, because they say, well, we're pro-family, as you just described.
Yeah.
But that word for family means one man, one woman, and a monogamous heterosexual marriage. So a same-sex marriage doesn't work. God's not going to bless that. So therefore, he's not going to transform society in those spheres you described.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so the logic.
The family is a good example of the Christian right that has adopted a dominionist worldview in order to permeate society and change it. Permeate the political sphere and change it so that in the end, God rules. You see, Jesus is king. Now, you mentioned, I just want to come back, if you grant me that, Clint, you mentioned about something about C. Peter Wagner.
Yes.
And C. Peter Wagner is actually a very important person. And it's great that you're aware of who he is, because a lot of people are not. And he's responsible ultimately now today for what is called the New Apostolic Reformation that started in his estimation, that started in 2001. Okay, this is something that began essentially in 2001.
Right, so it's fairly recent as far as in his timeline anyway.
That's it. It's very recent. Because before that, Wagner for many years was a very traditional Christian. He had spent many years as a missionary in South America, came back to America at one point, and things started to change for him when he met John Wimber in the 80s.
Because wasn't Wimber one of his students at Fuller?
That's it. It's a bit that in the sense that he created a course with Wimber at Fuller, and it was a course on signs and wonders.
Right. And Wimber, that's the connection.
That's the connection. And Wimber came to his class. So, and taught on that course, that famous course. And what happened is in the course, there was a kind of a practical session or part of the course where Wimber engaged in prayer and words of wisdom and prophecy. You see, so part of the course was theoretical, where Wimber taught about signs and wonders. And then for about an hour at the end of the course, he spent some time praying for people that were sick and things like that. And Wagner experienced in his estimation, he experienced some kind of healing. He had headaches, if my memory serves me right, and Wimber prayed for him and they went away. So he was very much impressed with what Wimber was doing, and he went through a paradigm shift at that time, because before that he was a secessionist. He didn't believe in the actualization of spiritual gifts for the modern world. He thought that spiritual gifts, prophecy, healings, things like that, had ceased at the time of the apostles, after the death of the apostles in the first century, second century, there was no need for spiritual gifts. So Wagner believed that. But when he met Wimber and started seeing that Wimber was actually doing and praying for people, and according to what they were seeing, or at least their interpretation of the events, they were seeing miracles and signs and wonders, that changed him. And that is the moment for Wagner. That's the moment where he connected with the supernatural. And he termed that movement that Wimber was actually experiencing through his vineyard churches and through his own ministry, he coined the term third wave of the Spirit. Mm. And the first wave, like he explains, there's a book that he wrote on this. In fact, he explains his journey. If you can read it, it's very good. Wagner penned that book. And he explains like the first wave was the Pentecostal movement at the beginning of the 20th century. So when mm-hmm. the Pentecostal movement came into existence through Azusa Street and probably just a little before that, that was the first wave of the Spirit. Then in the 60s, the Pentecostal experience was that of other evangelicals that had been that had problems with Pentecostalism, or at least the idea of speaking in tongues. So through the charismatic movement in the 60s, that was the second wave. And the third wave is in the 80s with Wimber and his vineyard churches. Mm. So at the time, there's no new apostolic reformation. It's just like Wagner is discovering this new paradigm, which is the spirit world and, you know, spiritual gifts and things like that. And as he's continuing his journey, at one point, Wimber passes away. He dies in 1997 of a cancer. And it was a bit incomprehensible, even for Wimber, that he had prayed for so many people.
Yeah, how come he's not being healed then?
and he hasn't been healed, and he dies from that cancer. I think it was a brain tumor, if my memory serves me right. And but after that, you know, Wagner gets in touch with other people. At one point, he meets this evangelist called Lewis Bush, and he discovers another facet of the spiritual world, which is. He engages in this discovery of what will be termed the spiritual warfare movement, and that happens in the 90s. You see, so he kind of discovers this idea that Christians are engaged in a kind of a spiritual battle against the forces of evil, and of course he bases all of this on his readings of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. So he continues in that movement, and there's all sorts of things that come out of there. Right? Ideas around what is called spiritual mapping, spiritual walks,
prayer walks,
exactly. The marches for Jesus, you know, in the 90s, that's where it comes from. And then eventually he meets this other guy near the end of the 90s, Chuck Pierce. And he goes through another type of paradigm shift, this time with the church. And he opens himself up to this idea that God has been restoring what we call the fivefold ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 to 13, where it talks about apostles, prophets, pastors, evangelists, and teachers. And so God has been restoring the fivefold ministries in these last days. And this is where the new apostolic reformation idea comes from. You see, so this is the kind of a second reformation, but now it includes apostolic leadership, people that are called by God to be apostles. To be significant leaders in this new movement. So this guy, you know, Peter Wagner, went through various types of paradigm shifts. He was a very influential individual in the evangelical world. He wrote so many books. Like, it's incredible the material that he has written over time. And eventually, one of his last books called Dominion. The book is called Dominion.
Yeah, I've read sections of that.
Yeah, that's his 2006 book. There he clearly states that he embraces Dominion theology. So and then comes back to Rushduni and others, and then links with Lance Wallnau, meets Lance Wallnau, mm-hmm. and starts talking about this Seven Mountains mandate, you see? So it's coming back to a full circle here.
That's
so it's very interesting. You see?
It is fascinating. And it's kind of a rabbit hole because that's what I've been finding. It's all about these names as I've been searching it. Once you find a key player like a C. Peter Wagner or a Rush Dooney, then you can start to connect him with influential figures so that you can connect Wagner and Wimber as you did. You can connect Rush Dooney with a guy called Gary North, who I believe it was his son-in-law.
Exactly.
And yet then they had a falling out from what I understand. However, Gary North still has his own thing going. I've read a lot of his stuff on his website. Now R.J. Rush Dooney is now dead, but I think his son Mark continues to run this organization called the Chalcedon Foundation or Chalcedon. So that's a Dominionist foundation or organization.
Yes, absolutely.
You can connect Mike Bickle to Wimber and Wagner. You can connect Bill Johnson, Chris Vallotton of Bethel Redding, Lance Wallnau. They've done rallies and things together. So these guys are running in those circles, as you say. So going back to your point, they might deny it publicly, but come on, the connections, the lines are unmistakably there.
Yes, absolutely. And they have a goal. The goal is social transformation.
Mm-hmm.
You see, when we come to the Seven Mountains mandate, it's about conquering the mountains of culture. Right? They've finally agreed on dividing this into seven different spheres or cultures: arts and entertainment, business, education, the family, government, media, and religion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the church has always been pretty much in charge of the religion mountain, and it's pretty much stayed there according to their understanding. It now needs to branch out. It needs to penetrate these other spheres in order to change society. So the goal is to essentially have and put in place key players at the top of each of these spheres. That means key leaders at the top of these spheres that will change the culture, change the mindset. If you give me permission, I have a fantastic quote by Lance Wallnau that talks about that strategy. If you just give me permission, I'm going to read it because it really encapsulates what this social transformation is about. And he wrote this in 2010, in fact. He co-edited with Bill Johnson, by the way.
I was going to say, they wrote a book on Invading Babylon, isn't that the book?
That's it. That's exactly it. So that's his book.
There's your connection, isn't it, with Bethel Redding and Lance Wallnau.
That's where you have the connection.
Yep.
But he says this in the chapter that he dedicates on the mountains. He says this. He says, quote, "The business of shifting culture or transforming nations does not require a majority of conversions. We make a mistake when we focus on winning a harvest in order to shape a culture. Together, Protestants and Catholics make up a 70% majority of the U.S. population, and such already have a majority consensus on key matters affecting marriage and abortion. Yet, they are still incapable of being more than a firewall to the minority who are advancing a same-sex ideology. If we do not need more conversions to shift a culture, what do we need? We need more disciples in the right places, the high places. Minorities of people can shape the agenda if properly aligned and deployed. The greatest gain in gay rights occurred during 10 years of our most conservative presidencies, and their movement has never been larger than 5 to 6% of the population. The church lacks cultural power because it focuses on changing the world from within the church mountain rather than releasing the church into the marketplace. The goal is to be the church that raises up disciples who go into all the world. Taking the gospel into all the world is no longer a simple journey of geography, The world is a matrix of overlapping systems or spheres of influence. Mm-hmm. We are called to go into the entire matrix and invade every system with an influence that liberates that system's fullest potential. Each sphere has a unique structure, culture, and stronghold of thinking, a worldview of its own. The battle in each sphere is over the ideas that dominate that sphere and between the individuals who have the most power to advance those ideas. The church must be represented in each sphere if the power of darkness is to be broken. End of quote. So that says it all.
Quote. That does say it all. Well, and going back to your point, you mentioned spiritual warfare, because that's got to be part of this transforming of cities, transforming of societies. Because anytime you see, well, not anytime, but I've seen, when you find these prayer rallies, and when you start looking again at the key players involved in these, what are they trying to do? They're saying, look, we're going to come together, cross denominations, and just pray for the transformation of our city, of our society. What, that seems so benign. It seems so good. But for example, there was a prayer rally in 2011. You probably are familiar with this, but the then governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who's now Trump's energy secretary, he held this rally in Houston, Texas. I mean, some 30,000 people attended, and it was all about praying to transform. Our nation is in crisis and all the rest of it. But what you find, who was helping to organize it? Guys like Mike Bickle, Lou Engel. These are key players in this Dominion theology, new apostolic reformation. What are they trying to do? They're trying to clear out the spiritual, the demonic strongholds that, you know, somehow have taken over their city or their neighborhood or whatever. Once they kick those demons out with the power of God, then that transformation can start to happen. So exactly. there's a definite agenda tied into this spiritual warfare. And like, say, spiritual mapping. Well, I got to find the demon over Liverpool or Houston, Texas, or, you know, Montreal. There's all these territorial demons.
Absolutely. And that's based on readings like Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, that talks about principalities and powers. We are not fighting against flesh and blood.
Exactly.
Principalities, powers, and evil spirits in the heavenly places. So, of course, they base their ideas on certain scriptural texts, and they have a particular way of interpreting that.
Right. It's not for nothing. In other words, there is, in their view, it's biblical warrant for this belief. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And the thing is about spiritual warfare is it's also problematic. Because when you think in terms of, let's say, spiritual mapping, and of course, to conquer the seven mountains, you need to clear the skies, like you said, of all demonic influence over a certain mountain. But if you go to let's say, people engaged in missionary work, it's quite demeaning for other cultures to tell them that, they're under the bondage of satanic.
Right. Spiritually blind because
spiritual, exactly. It's quite demeaning, and it's kind of colonial,
very condescending, and
very colonialist as a mentality. You know, we're gonna pray for you because you're ignorant and you're blind, and you need to be delivered from the forces of evil. You know, it's very demeaning, condescending, like you say, to other cultures and other peoples that have their own traditions. You see. So it's all about spiritual colonization.
Yeah, in order for Christianity to win, it's got to displace,
of course,
these other beliefs. Well,
of course.
Going back to that point about listening for key phrases, and I was listening to this morning when I was getting ready for work, Paula White, who is, of course, one of Donald Trump's main spiritual advisors or whatever she calls herself. There's a viral video that's going around now. It's from Now This. You may have seen it, but it's like, this is Trump's spiritual advisor. A couple of things she said in the little clips they played, it struck out like a red flag, where it was like she started talking about how she's renouncing these demons of this, and she's claiming authority over that, and she's doing all that. When she goes to the White House, she's praying and she's claiming this territory for Christ, and she, wherever she goes, that's where God goes. And I thought, man, that is straight Dominion theology right there. I'm hearing this absolutely. Now, she might say, I don't know what Dominion theology is, but she's saying it. She's participating in it.
Yeah. Unknowingly.
maybe knowingly. I don't know what her connections are with other people like Bickle and Johnson and some of the other key players, but yeah, anytime that's what really stuck out at me was I started hearing that and I'm like, bam, that is Dominion theology right there.
But you know that even in the New Apostolic Reformation, people like Wagner were very much intrigued with prosperity gospel.
Right.
And she's from that stream, right? The prosperity gospel preachers. So Wagner also believed that God wanted people to prosper, and it was a sign of blessing to be to be prosperous in a sense. He went in so many directions that you like it's sometimes it becomes like a you become almost like it's hard to follow because there's so many streams, like you said.
It's very difficult.
It's difficult because they're all over the place, and you have to recognize the language. You have to make the connections between these individuals. You have to understand what Dominionism is. You have to have a working definition of what it is to be able to really make sure that, okay, this is what we're talking about. We're not just talking about social conservatism, you know, where there are Christians that are social conservatives, and that's fine if that's their choice, you know, but they have no Dominionist agenda. But when you hear people like White, yes, you have to, there's spiritual language there, spiritual warfare language.
Oh, absolutely.
Very clear.
As you say, in my research of people like Lance Wall now and other people that are in this seven mountains, Dominion theology, the seven mountains mandate. I mean, it's all over his website. Like you say, he's written books, and I was watching videos that he's talking about it on YouTube, sketching it out on a whiteboard. But one of the things he mentions, as you talked about with wealth, they believe that the reason Christians need to have wealth is so that they can then become influencers in their sphere of influence. And so that's part of the thinking, the mentality, the model, I guess you could say, is that it's not maybe not as extreme as the prosperity gospel preachers, but there's got to be an overlap there that where they're saying, you know, God wants you wealthy so that you can use your wealth for his purposes, for the kingdom, to advance the kingdom. And that's all part of this mandate.
Yeah. You know that C. Peter Wagner wrote a book called The Great Transfer of Wealth, which is really focused on, if we want to bring social change, we need money.
Exactly. So there's your theology.
They believe that there's a time that's coming where God will take the wealth of the pagans and give it to the church, transfer it to the church. There's a supernatural moment where that will happen, and that will permit the establishment of social transformation and the kingdom of God. So that in the New Apostolic Reformation, there's all sorts of things they believe, but one of them is this idea that the wealth of the nations will be transferred to God's people.
Yeah, I've heard that before. I've come across that teaching.
Yeah. So they believe all sorts of stuff. The New Apostolic Reformation, they have the Seven Mountains Mandate. They've integrated Wagner's ideas around spiritual warfare, what we talked about with Wimber for signs and wonders, this idea of a great wealth, transfer of wealth, fivefold ministry, this idea of the fivefold ministry of Ephesians chapter 4. Ideas around even post-millennialism, they've integrated that. Extra-biblical revelation, where God speaks outside the Bible, that God can give directions to individuals and revelations that are outside Scripture.
Oh, he absolutely,
beyond Scripture.
And they get into some, it's almost like the more bizarre it is, the more extreme it is. I mean, I've been, I've been doing a lot of research on Bethel Redding in California, Bill Johnson, Christopher Lawton. I mean, I've got a list going on a Google document And I just keep, this is like titled Strange Teachings at Bethel Reading. And I first came up with three or four. I'm up to like 10 or 12 now, where it's like, you know, grave soaking. They're going to lay on the grave of some great departed Christian saint and soak up their blessings. And somehow that's going to be transferred to them, and gold dust falling from the sky and during the services, and on and on and on and on. And it's just, it's just bizarre. To me, it's more and more striking of a cult, where they've got so many of the sort of the markers of a classic cult movement, charismatic leaders and information control and other factors that you go, man, this is, I don't even know what this is. This doesn't seem like anything that I grew up in, you know, in sort of evangelicalism back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, they always have a verse to support their ideas.
There's always a verse.
There's always a verse somewhere, like the grave sucking thing. There's a passage in, I think it's 1 or 2 Kings, where the bones of Elijah are somewhere, and
that's
someone
touches. They threw a dead body in the tomb. Yeah.
That's it.
As soon as he hit the bones of the prophet, he jumped back to life, and his friends were shocked.
Exactly. Yeah, like that, you know. And
there's power in them bones.
Benny Hinn used to go to Catherine Kuhlman's grave.
I remember that.
You know, all of these things. So they have verses, and they have like experiences to kind of back up their ideas. It's cherry picking. It's proof texting, but that's done nonetheless.
Maybe that's the thing to help the listeners to kind of raise that awareness, because. You know, I've put on here on the list, what about things like hard dominion theology, soft dominion theology, kingdom now theology, restorationism, latter reign. There's so many names. How do you pick your way through that minefield? Maybe it's about when you hear key phrases and words that should trigger you and go, ah, this is what we're talking about. I can now put my finger on it.
Yes. And people have to, at the same time, Clint, you know this because you're doing research on this. Mm. It takes time
to research this.
It takes time. There's no, like, fill in the blanks. Could you give me a little chart quickly, you know? It takes time to learn about this. So it's good that you're engaged in doing your podcast. I try to do – I have a YouTube videos. I try to do videos. I sometimes do Twitter threads, you know. I try to engage in a public discourse around these questions. It takes time for people to know about these things and to be familiar with that type of language. You're talking about latter rain. A lot of what we see in the New Apostolic Reformation now is inspired from the latter rain movement. The latter rain movement of the 40s that started in Saskatchewan here in Canada. It comes from that. A lot of the same ideas, the manifest sons of God and all of these ideas, Joel's army, the end times Christian army that will defeat the forces of evil, all of this. There's so much, it's mind boggling. It's hard to follow, but you have to take the time to be aware of some of these key terms. And I do encourage your listeners to continue listening to your own podcast. And people need to almost get an education in this stuff to make their way out of it.
Really. Definitely. Do. And I'm appreciative of the work that you've done as well in this field. In fact, Chris Shelton and I are going to be doing a podcast on his show about this thing, because he's an ex-Scientologist, but in talking to me and him being on my show, about me being on his show, we've started talking about this. And he'd never heard of this Dominion theology before, because he's not very well versed in the evangelical side of things coming out of Scientology. Yeah. But it's kind of opened his eyes to all this stuff, and he's like, "We need to do more. We need to talk about this more." So I said, "Well, I'm going to be talking to you, so I'll pick." your brains, and then I'll use that material for our other podcast. So,
and you know, even in, because of course we identify more Dominion theology with Protestantism or evangelicalism, but you know, there's dominionist tendencies, for example, in groups like Opus Dei, which is a Catholic, you know, there's dominionist ideas there too, where it's about bringing the Catholic teaching in all the spheres of society. The recent comments that we had from William Barr recently that was invited at Notre Dame, that was another video that went viral. He had a bunch of dominionist talking points there, how he was demeaning towards secularism and how it was dangerous and how it was, you know, it was important that the country was founded on Judeo-Christian traditions. And he's a Catholic and he has connections to Opus Dei.
Right. So where is he getting these talking points from?
It's there. You see, dominion theology permeates this, like Clarkson says, despite the theological agenda. You see, it goes beyond a specific theology. It could be recuperated by any theology, in a sense. So Catholics, you can have Catholics that are amillennialists that can embrace a dominionist talking point.
Yeah, it's very pervasive.
It's very pervasive. So we have to be aware of what it is, we have to know what it means, and we have to understand like the key concepts and ideas that emerge from that ideology and who uses it. In the past, of course, we've seen Christian Reconstructionism. We see it present in the New Apostolic Reformation. Some people are a bit less aware of, in the 80s, a movement called the Coalition on Revival that embodied, essentially, Christian Reconstructionist ideas and managed to really bring into the evangelical world dominion theology. It's fascinating. And really bridging the gap between non-charismatics and charismatics. Like the Coalition on Revival managed to bring both non-charismatics, charismatics, or Pentecostals together over these same issues.
Exactly. They were able to come together.
Yeah, that's it. So it's dominion theology has managed to do that.
Exactly. And I think I'm hoping that off the back of this chat that you and I have had, that people listening to this, it's raised their awareness and maybe raised their antenna a little bit, because it's so pervasive and it's so subtle. I mean, going back to the family, you know, they have infiltrated all over the world. And so they have some key players in key places. I mean, Mike Pence, for example, Vice President Pence, he buys into some of this dominionist theology, you know, and you'll hear him say certain things, but he's very covert about how he goes about it.
Yeah.
You know, he's one of the more high profile people because he happens to be the vice president. But if you look at the people that he associates with and he in the past, these are, again, going back to those key names. I keep coming up with, you know, key players, you know, so people need to be aware of what's going on. Well, now, I don't want to keep you too long, but how can people get a hold of you? What's the best way to contact you? Because you say you do YouTube and you're on Twitter. So what's your social media sort of platform?
Yeah. So I'm most often on Twitter. So that's the social platform that I use the most. So my handle, I don't know if you can provide it on your website or.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, that's it. @ Prof A. Gagné. So that's my handle, and you can follow me. And if you know you're going to get a lot of information from my Twitter handle. I also have a YouTube channel. I have over 40 clips now on these questions and related issues. Clips that vary between 20 and 30 minutes. I did an entire series on the Latter Rain movement, done some stuff on dominionism, New Apostolic Reformation, did a big, big series on that, apostolic centers, the Seven Mountains Mandate, a lot of stuff on that. I did the series on Coalition on Revival, biblical politicism and things like that, or I would say rather political biblicism. My YouTube channel, Andre Gagné, very easy. And, of course I'm on Facebook too. So I have a page on Facebook. But people on those platforms will also find my institutional address at Concordia. So if they want to email me with questions, or you know, they want to connect somehow, it'll be a pleasure, definitely to chat. And sometimes, you know, people have good ideas. They want to learn about something. They can give me ideas about what they would like to hear, if it's in my area, of course. And it'd be a pleasure to connect with some of your listeners. Definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's always about making connections, isn't it? Is finding people that are doing this work out there, and then you go, okay, so this is what I've got. Let's compare notes. Let's compare what we're talking about. So I'm so glad that we finally got together and made this happen, especially now as all this impeachment stuff is looming and we're seeing all this stuff coming out, you know, so it's going to be interesting to see what the sort of evangelical right-wing support for a guy like Donald Trump will do in the months going forward now. So keep your eye on the Dominionists in this discussion and see what happens.
Of course. Absolutely. Well, I really want to thank you. I really want to thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope we're going to have the chance to chat again. Maybe something on, you know, we can zero in on a specific movement at one point if you want, anytime. And it was great talking with you. Thank you so much for your kind invitation.
Yes, I've absolutely loved meeting you, Andre. And yeah, I mean, we do need to do this again, because what we've done here is just, like you say, a brief, even though it's been almost an hour or so, I don't know, overview of this stuff. But we need to go take a deep dive into some of this stuff. And I've got a lot of information on Bethel Redding. And so that's something that we need to maybe take a dive into and sort of chart out some of the others, because they're getting their fingers into a lot of political stuff in California.
Absolutely.
They've got the mayor of Redding is one of the elders at Bethel Redding, and they've got all sorts of stuff going on. So there's some pretty alarming things, really, I think. So let's definitely keep in touch. Thank you so much, Andre, for being such a great guest on Mindshift Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And I would say to anyone out there, as Andre says, if you want to get a hold of myself, you can follow me on Twitter. That's, like Andre, the best way to get a hold of me, at MindShift2018, or you can follow Andre as well. Look him up on Facebook. There'll also be the connections in the show notes. So thank you for joining myself and Professor Dr. Andre Gagne for this bonus episode, part two of Dominion Theology. I will see you again on MindShift Podcasts.